The Sunstone Theological Society presents Evan Meekum and the Mormon Community, recorded live at the 1988 Sunstone Theological Symposium, held August 17th through the 20th, 1988. We take you to the University Park Hotel in Salt Lake City, Utah, where the program is just now beginning.
Interested in the political career and the ultimate impeachment and trial, but also of Evan Meekum, but also the story of what it did internally to LDS people living in Arizona during the last couple years. We're going to switch the order of the papers. We'll first hear from Karen Coates, whose paper's entitled The Holy War Surrounding Evan Meekum. Karen is a native of Arizona, although her parents now summer in Utah, where it's 95 in the shade, and is currently a faculty associate at ASU with a specialty in music and music theater. But as a young married professional on a university campus, she took an unbelievable amount of heat over Evan Meekum, and I think got interested in the process early on and has a very, very exciting paper for us. After Karen, we're privileged to hear from Eduardo Pagan, who's a graduate student at the University of Arizona with a bachelor's degree from ASU, so the Sun Devils are well represented, except rarely in the Rose Bowl. He first was working for a student newspaper, gathering material as a political science student, published an editorial, was picked up by the Arizona Republic and the Salt Lake Tribune, which he just found out about now and wondered if he missed out on some royalties. But on kind of a brief political analysis of the impact of Meekum on the LDS community and showing that there were other points of view, and has since published an article in Sunstone entitled Raising Arizona, The Clash in the Church Over Evan Meekum. But his paper is entitled Prophecy, Patriotism, and Paranoia, The Meekum Ideology in Review. Because Professor Williams could not be here for personal health reasons, I've consulted with him on the phone, and then I'll respond to the papers, and then we'll have questions from the audience. So we'll start with Karen.
Good afternoon. I'm not here as a political scientist, sociologist, or a historian, but as one of many Arizonans who are Latter-day Saints who will never forget Evan Meekum. I have been asked to sketch out some highlights of what has been called Arizona's Holy War, the war of public opinion surrounding Evan Meekum, religion, and frequently the Mormon Church. In 1986, Evan Meekum was approached by friends who asked him to run for governor for a fifth time. Meekum thoughtfully considered their request. He took the question to his family, and as one friend, Shirley Whitlock, relates, they decided to fast and pray about it, and their family had a three-day fast. Then it was confirmed that he should run and that he would win. With this foreknowledge, Evan Meekum entered the campaign. Meekum the Republican ran against two candidates, a Democrat and an Independent. On election night, he calmly and quietly confided to a friend, "I have assurance that I'm going to win. I know I'm going to win." When the votes were tabulated, it seemed that God had worked in a mysterious way to fulfill his promise to Evan Meekum. 61% of the voters stayed home in the lowest voter turnout in 44 years, and Meekum won the election with only 39% of the vote. When President Ezra Taft Benson appeared on the podium at Meekum's inauguration, some LDS supporters believed it was a sign that the church was endorsing the new governor, or that the governor had a divine calling to office. A rumor circulated that at the time of the inauguration, Meekum and President Benson attended the temple together, and inside the temple, Meekum was set apart by the prophet to be Arizona's new governor. When Governor Meekum made national headlines by rescinding the holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., some critics suspected sinister motives for his action. They blamed two groups linked to Meekum. One, the far-right political wing for its allegations that King was a communist, and two, the church for its history of priesthood denial to blacks. Reaction to the King holiday cancellation indicated that Mormonism would play a significant role in public perception of Governor Meekum. It also was the signal for many Latter-day Saints to jump on the Meekum bandwagon. They thought Meekum was merely the target of religious persecution. 2 months after the holiday was rescinded, new charges of Mormon bigotry appeared. When Meekum said he liked Cleon Skousen's book, The Making of America, quotations from the book surfaced in the press. One said slave owners were the worst victims of slavery, and two referred to black children as pickaninnies. Because of the holiday cancellation and the pickaninny flack, the head of Arizona's Office of Affirmative Action later persuaded Meekum to attend black church services in the Phoenix area on Sundays after he attended his ward. Meekum would spend the rest of his term in office trying to prove to blacks that he and his religion were not their enemies, but within months, others too would become offended by Meekum's remarks. Meekum criticized reporters, professional entertainers, and rock concert fans. He called one journalist a non-person and called his supporters the good people. He made other remarks which offended Hispanics, Japanese, Jews, and working women. At a banquet held at the U of U last September, Meekum said, "This is a great Christian nation for everybody." And at a Scottsdale synagogue, Meekum later repeated this statement, declaring, "I said it and I'll say it again." Reporters also baited Governor Meekum with many questions about gay rights, and he answered them. He often said that although he had no agenda for cracking down on homosexuals, he thought homosexuality was an unacceptable lifestyle. He also protested the existence of Arizona State University's Lesbian and Gay Academic Union. He told a radio caller identifying himself as Brother Hogan, a gay member of the church, "If you are a member of the same church I am, you have evidently changed your lifestyle because the church I belong to does not allow homosexuals to participate under any circumstances." Statements like these fell upon the ears of one attentive listener, a wealthy young businessman named Ed Buck. Buck was the creator of the Meekum Watchdog Committee, a group which would later become the Meekum Recall Committee and would collect signatures of over 300,000 Arizonans who supported the governor's recall. In February of 1987, a pro-Meekum group called Arizonans for Traditional American Values held a press conference at which their leader Julian Sanders exposed Buck's homosexuality and condemned him for his current drug indictment and his arrest for public sexual indecency. The far right later alleged that Buck had received a year of training on a scholarship by the communists in Yugoslavia. These allegations fired up the governor's supporters. To Chrisman Lewis, publisher of the unofficial Mormon tabloid The Latter-day Sentinel, Buck's homosexuality confirmed that that is Satan's side. To Shirley Whitlock, president of the Arizona Eagle Forum, evidence like this showed the character, or lack of it, of the opposition. The Meekumites, as they became known in the Best Book of Mormon tradition, thought allegations against Buck would boost their cause immeasurably and often said the recall was a homosexual movement. Tables were turned when it was revealed that the president of the 2,000-member Evan Meekum fan club, 17-year-old Kip Shippey, had been convicted of child molesting in 1984. Meekum and his camp shrugged off the obvious irony, but Steve Benson, a Meekum critic, concluded, "If you're going to argue that to oppose Governor Meekum is to support homosexuality, then to support Evan Meekum is to condone heterosexual child molestation." Church members engaged in their own stirring debate. Publisher Chrisman Lewis defended Meekum in a Latter-day Sentinel editorial by saying, "Gay questions have no win answers. To attack gays is discriminatory. To accept them is immoral." He later conceded to a reader who countered that church members may reject the homosexual lifestyle but must accept homosexuals as individuals. Another Sentinel reader wrote, "When a statewide radio and television audience heard Evan Meekum say, 'Ed Buck, we have checked you out. You're not worth a hill of beans,' we winced. No matter who Ed Buck is, a true Christian would never tell him nor anyone he is worthless, a non-person, non-existent." After witnessing the Meekum debate that would rage through the coming months, one political strategist concluded that Meekum generated either fanatical support or wild disdain. An LDS news anchor for a Phoenix television station, Linda Turley, describes the split among Arizonans. Quote, "There were those who took President Benson's presence at Meekum's inauguration as gospel, a prophet's direction to follow the new governor. In that midst, there were those who have known Meekum in the church for years and can only say good about the man. There were those who believed that a man who received revelation of his governorship must be receiving divine guidance. There are those who approve of his political platform and embrace his theory that he is a victim of the media, the power brokers, the attorney general, and a conspiracy. On the other shore were those who saw Meekum as incapable of accomplishing his honorable platform, a platform which contained all the right buzzwords and causes: war on drugs, the mafia, the racing commission, government corruption, taxes, power mongers, pornography. They saw him as a man who found it difficult to delegate and to trust, who failed to surround himself with competent people and advisors, who failed to listen to seasoned and supportive politicians and friends who tried to warn him early on to soften his rhetoric and his approach to various controversies, who failed to practice compromise even in areas where no real harm would have come to his own agenda, whose judgment was in question. End of quote. These conspiracy theories that Turley describes were central to the Meekumite philosophy. Meekum himself was certain that there was a conspiracy in force to remove him from office. He identified the conspirators: the Phoenix 40, a businessman's group, the Old Guard, the National Gay Rights Liberation Movement, the Democratic Party, the Phoenix newspapers, the homosexuals, the drug people, the pornographers, the university crowd, the go-along-to-get-along people. Some Latter-day Saints made stronger accusations against the conspirators. One man wrote to the Latter-day Sentinel, "If we examine their motivations, I believe we will find sufficient evidence to label the Phoenix 40 a secret combination that we have seen as the cause of the destruction of many ancient peoples, the Nephites among them." Shirley Whitlock agrees, saying, "I don't understand how members of the church living in this day cannot believe in conspiracies. It's secret combinations of groups that are out to get the governor." The news media also played an important role in these conspiracy theories. Meekum's dislike for the press was common knowledge, but to it he added the charge that the media was trying to destroy him. Some Meekumites from the Mesa area wrote letters to the Arizona Republic saying that some of their reporters were in league with the Antichrist. Many journalists received death threats. The Latter-day Sentinel, an unofficial voice of the church in Arizona, enlisted in the media war in April of 1987. Hoping to offset the other news media's apparent bias, the Sentinel's editor and president, Chrisman Lewis, abandoned his newspaper's non-political tenet. Soon a number of pro-Meekum editorials and features appeared in the Sentinel. Lewis sometimes appealed to the religious sympathies of his readers. One of his editorials read, "I'm sure if you were to visit with Meekum personally, he would share with you his story of why he decided to run. To the world, it looked like vain ambition. To the many who try to follow promptings in their lives, they knew there was another dimension to the decision. When he was elected, the world called it luck, but thousands knelt in thanks." The Sentinel also took on LDS cartoonist Steve Benson. Benson, the political cartoonist for the Arizona Republic and a critic of Meekum, was no stranger to attacks from church members who thought his cartoons sometimes damaged the reputation of the church and of Benson's grandfather, President Ezra Taft Benson. Chrisman Lewis telephoned Steve Benson, hoping Benson knew his grandfather's opinion of the Meekum situation and would tell him. Lewis then restructured this freewheeling conversation into a question and answer format. Benson was quoted as saying, "I wish I could feel at liberty to repeat what he," meaning President Benson, "has said about the governor. I just know Grandpa has been watching the situation down here, and there's reason to be concerned. I'm not in a position to divulge everything I know because there are people in position of authority who wish not to go on record." Benson also cited reasons he wished the governor would resign. Next to this interview, Lewis reprinted Benson's now infamous cartoon showing the Salt Lake City Temple and a banner on the end of Moroni's trumpet which read, "Resign, Ev." The Benson interview triggered a barrage of letters to the editor from enraged readers. Three wrote that Benson had made a mockery out of the temple, that he was immature, impetuous, insensitive, and obnoxious, and that his comments smelled of priestcraft and damnable heresy. The letters section soon became a hot spot for debate about Meekum, and frequently the section ran for pages. The Sentinel printed the few anti-Meekum letters it received, but the large majority of Sentinel readers and writers were highly supportive of the governor. Some quoted scripture or modern-day prophets to support their points. Excuse me. On the night of December 3, 1987, Steve Benson and Evan Meekum had a lengthy telephone conversation. Benson reports that at one point during their conversation, Meekum turned to his wife, Flo, and said, "I need to take some time with Steve because I'm really afraid his salvation is in jeopardy." Benson reports that Meekum made other statements with religious overtones. Meekum said that he obeyed the commandments, that Benson had fallen off the beam, and that only Meekum's bishop could judge him, and his bishop, he said, was his son. Which is true. Reports of this conversation became public knowledge, as did the story that some members of Benson's extended family wanted him uninvited to Thanksgiving dinner. It was also rumored that Cleon Skousen said Benson would have to answer to God because of what he had done to Evan Meekum. Sadly, this controversy divided families and friends within the church. Linda Turley said, "It was apparent early on that Evan Meekum's trials and tribulations would harm us all, but few of us were equal to the trauma." She relates, "In my extended family, which had been close and caring, division took place among certain family members. Some of us remain at a distance. As a result, I found my anger against Meekum grew. Unreasonable or not, I hold him responsible for some of the upheaval within the church and my family." A former bishop, Gary Patton, told Newsweek magazine of disputes within his family. Steve Benson's family also split over the issue. "My husband and I joined those who experienced these struggles as we discussed Meekum not only with each other, but also with our parents, our brothers, and our sisters." Many church members undoubtedly tried to avoid debate, even in the parking lots. Some members hid their disappointment in Meekum and bit their tongues. Sherry Allen, who did not vote for Meekum, said that she and her husband, quote, "became conspicuously silent about who we voted for fear of being labeled heretics." The subject of Meekum occasionally came up during fast meetings and other church gatherings. One woman reportedly talked in a testimony meeting for half an hour, saying that faithful Latter-day Saints needed to support the governor. Chrisman Lewis heard that a ward in Mesa fasted for Meekum during a difficult time. He relates, "I think there were a lot of people fasting. The word was spreading all over, fast this weekend. Like the weekend of the impeachment vote and the weekend of the hearings, there was a lot of fasting going on." An LDS representative in the Arizona House, Mark Killian, tells, "I heard that they were having fasts for Ev before the general election and before the primary, that there was this network of fasting going on all over Arizona. When Ev got in deep trouble, I heard there were several wards that had fasts for him, and Salt Lake cracked down on them and said, 'You cannot do that.'" Some regional representatives sent letters to be read in Arizona priesthood meetings stating that Meekum was a non-issue during church meetings. Some members apparently used church contacts to get the word out. One radio talk show host said that his station received calls from members of the church who maintained that they have been encouraged in church to call radio talk shows to support Governor Meekum. One listener heard radio programs where members of the church would call in and, unaware of what to do, would admit, "My neighbor said I was supposed to call." LDS bookstores even promoted pro-Meekum literature, including books, tabloids, and even song cassettes. Followers spread stories, which they believed confirmed Meekum's political innocence, that Meekum regularly attended the temple and was often seen crying in its prayer circles, that he met with President Benson in June and or August of 1987, and that President Benson promised him he would win if he continues doing what's right, and that both President Benson and former Arizonan Elder H. Burke Peterson had given blessings to Evan Meekum and his brother Willard. Some followers said that Meekum's persecution mirrored that experienced by the prophets. Betty Smith of Meekum's hometown, Altamont, Utah, drew a parallel between Meekum and Joseph Smith because Joseph was ridiculed, persecuted, and then murdered because of his beliefs. Meekumite Jim Robson reported that Cleon Skousen had called Meekum a modern-day Isaiah, and Robson added, "Isaiah was beaten, spit on, and persecuted as a prophet." Other followers outdid comparisons to the prophets. The author of Meekum, Arizona's Fighting Governor, wrote of his impeachment, "One is put in mind of a scene about 2,000 years ago. One group said of the man on trial, 'I find no fault in this man.' The other group said, 'Crucify him. You know the rest of the story.'" A Sentinel reader penned, "The Senate impeachment trial reminds me of an almost identical trial that occurred nearly 2,000 years ago. At that time, they also screamed, 'Crucify him, crucify him,' long before a trial. One man made the papers when he interrupted a Phoenix precinct meeting, shouting that the Republicans needed to stand by Meekum rather than criticize him. He cried, 'The more we can keep our Christ child to ourselves, the more we can protect it from crucifixion.'" Threats were made. Steve Western, a church member who had a recall bumper sticker on his car, was told by another Latter-day Saint, "You better wise up or you'll be eternally damned." Prior to the election, someone put a flyer on his car at a ward picnic that stated, "If someone votes improperly, it is a sin." An LDS woman told Mark Killian that one Sunday, her stake president's wife told her that she didn't think she should be at Relief Society or sit next to her because she wouldn't support Meekum. Referring to these as a kind of religious blackmail, Mark Killian observes, "Nobody when I was running for office said you have to support Mark because he's LDS. Nobody when Stan Turley, an Arizona statesman, ran for office said you have to support him because he was LDS. And I said, what's the difference with Ev?" Members of other churches, particularly those from the so-called moral majority wing, provided much of Meekum's support. Baptist pastor Wesley Darby warned Phoenix area clergy, "Every day we hear the shouts of the sodomites, the socialists, and the secret power brokers as they attack our governor. If you don't want to live in Sodom and have a family problem like Lot's, then come out of your closet of prayer and onto the battlefield." Editors of a Christian tabloid called Footprints also printed a pro-Meekum issue. Conversely, Meekum's critics put him in the same basket as Pat Robertson, Jimmy Swaggart, Oral Roberts, and Jim Baker. Some supporters went to great extremes to express their anger. During the impeachment trials, all of the state's senators and representatives, even Latter-day Saints, received threatening telephone calls and letters from Meekum followers. Republic and Gazette editor Pat Murphy wrote, "I cannot recall in the past seeing such a volume of letters to the editor that are unusable because of the vicious, vile, obscene, and vulgar language used by authors to condemn Meekum critics and to extol the governor." Recall leader Aline Gordon reports that recall workers were called lesbians and AIDS carriers and added, "If you were active in recall, your phone rang with death threats all the time." Did Mormons engage in this kind of activity? We don't know. In one unfortunate and ironic twist, the target of Meekumite violence was a Latter-day Saint. 58-year-old Betty Foster had become a friend of Ed Buck to show him that not all church members supported Meekum. One day while she was standing in a grocery store checkout line, Foster heard a man in front of her call Buck a big faggot. She asked the man to keep his opinions to himself, and in the argument that ensued, the man's companion, a middle-aged woman, swung her purse and hit Foster in the head, cutting her face and giving her a black eye. With predictable zeal, the church's antagonists took advantage of the Meekum excitement to further their own causes. Mormon Watch, an anti-Mormon organization based in the Phoenix area, interviews and wrote letters to editors. In one letter, they told of the Mormon belief that men can become gods and concluded, "Meekum is playing the game to the hilt. Convinced of a popular mandate, he is carrying his celestial vision for Arizona forward, and damn anyone who gets in the way." Representatives of Mormon Watch and a second anti-Mormon organization, Concerned Christians, also misrepresented the church by saying that Mormons had a religious obligation to support the governor and that bishops would take action against Meekum critics within their wards. A former member of the church, Deborah Lake, created a stir with a forceful editorial for the New Times. She wrote, "Meekum began as a Mormon boy and became a Mormon man. There is no other upbringing on earth so perfectly designed to transform someone with weak wits into a monster." And I know the conditioning that begins at birth, the conditioning that whispers to Mormon boys that they are chosen and that their weirdest ideas are sanctioned by God. She concluded, "For a small-minded man, Mormonism becomes a way of not reflecting on your own actions. That is how Evan Meekum rules." The executive director of the Arizona Civil Liberties Union, Lewis Rhodes, reports that after Meekum's inauguration, the ACLU received its first taste of anti-Mormon sentiment in the form of negative letters and phone calls. Tom Likas, program director for talk radio station KFYI, heard many anti-Mormon comments during his station's call-in programs. "On a typical day, I heard one caller ask Chrisman Lewis of the Sentinel, 'I'm concerned about the apparent conflict between the secret oath that Evan Meekum took in the Mormon temple and the oath that he took to serve, quote, impartially, unquote, as governor of Arizona.' Some callers threatened physical harm to any Arizona Mormons." Why were these people so distressed about the church's effect on Meekum? It seemed to them that Meekum used his belief in God and Mormonism to promote his cause. Was Meekum doing this? Steve Benson heard that at a family picnic attended by many supporters, Meekum said, "The people we should hate aren't worth hating, and a just God in heaven will do all the getting even for us that we need." Mark Killian heard that at a stake youth fireside, Meekum said that God is on his side and the devil was the one causing all of his problems. And appearing before nearly 2,000 fans who crowded into Mesa's Centennial Hall, Meekum said, "Although there is not an established state religion, it is important to have God as a co-partner in all governmental acts." He also said, "God will give us the direction, but we're the ones who have to put the motion power to the drive wheels that push us along. If we listen to his direction, he will tell us the course to steer." And at the press conference following his acquittal, the first thing Meekum said was, "First, I want to express the gratitude of myself, Florence, and our entire family to the Lord for answering the hundreds of thousands of prayers offered in our behalf." Is there a difference between the civil religion of Americans such as Abraham Lincoln and that of Meekum? Some would say yes. In reference to Pat Robertson, historian Edwin Gostad said, "Abraham Lincoln was profoundly religious, but never willing to say he spoke for God or that God spoke to him." Steve Benson agreed when he said of Evan Meekum, "On the one hand, the governor will declare that he has no problem with the First Presidency making it clear that there is a division between one's personal political viewpoints and the position that the church may take. Yet on the other hand, the former governor is sending these not too subtle messages that those who support him, whether in or out of the church, have God's blessing and approval." But Meekum denies that he drags the LDS church into politics. In a brief interview with me, he said, "I never involve the church in politics. The brethren have said to get involved civically. We never do it in the name of the church. I adhere to that strictly." He also said that he felt Latter-day Saints understood that they don't have to support him. He said, "We," meaning LDS, "we don't get angry with each other if we disagree on political issues or any other issue." Elsewhere, he has said, "I've got a right to worship however I want. Now, you can say that this is a great Jewish nation all you want. I'll never challenge it. You say what you believe, it's all right with me. You need to allow me that same right." After the state grand jury indicted Evan Meekum and his brother Willard, Evan said, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord. We need not try to get even with anyone in this life. There is a just God in heaven who will mete out eternal justice to us all in the life hereafter." The religious zeal of his supporters was evident that day as they carried signs reading, "Deliver our governor from the wicked, dear Lord God Almighty," and, "We support you, governor," Psalm 68, "Let God arise, let his enemies be scattered." Meekum's followers believe that the charges were part of an unconstitutional railroad job to remove him from office. Latter-day Saint Meekumites were certain that Meekum's battle was foreseen in Joseph Smith's prophecy that the Constitution of the United States would hang by a thread and that the elders of the church would labor to save it. During the legislative impeachment proceedings brought against Meekum, supporters from the Mesa area flooded legislative offices with pro-Meekum letters, many worded exactly the same way but signed by different people. LDS Representative Jack Brown said that the governor's supporters repeatedly threatened to remove legislators from office if they voted for impeachment. And marching in protest at the state capitol building, Meekumite families engaged in altercations with anti-Meekumites. The Latter-day Sentinel published what looked like a survey of legislators' views on impeachment and asked readers to refer to the list on this page and call your state representative many times if necessary to express your feelings on how the impeachment hearings are being conducted. Legislators became incensed because the survey was not a survey and most legislators had never been contacted. Lewis issued a retraction, but his mistake brought a little notoriety to the Sentinel. During the impeachment trial, Meekum's image was hampered by his testimony. Representative Mark Killian of Mesa reports that before the governor testified in the House, calls to his office were running about 90-1 against impeachment. But after Meekum took the stand and began testifying, calls to his office against impeachment dropped to about half of the total calls. At the conclusion of his testimony, Meekum accused Representative Jim Skelly of being a political enemy, citing Skelly's participation in a racetrack scam. When the House of Representatives impeached Governor Meekum by a vote of 46-14, all five LDS representatives voted against impeachment. Mark Killian cast one of those votes, but he denounced the governor and defended his friend Jim Skelly in a tearful speech. He said, "I resent Evan Meekum and everything he stands for. The way I was raised is nothing at all the way I see Mr. Meekum conduct his affairs. He has continually skated along life, following the lowest common denominator of social behavior, and that's barely eking by the law. He can best be described by a man I admire greatly, and that was Stan Turley, and that was being an ethical pygmy. And his outlandish, rude, classless, John Birch accusations he made against Mr. Skelly today turn my stomach. After this denunciation, Killian received death threats and was told he should be excommunicated. He relates, "I had a lot of people write me letters and quote me out of the 121st section of the DNC about unrighteous dominion." Representatives Killian and Skelly were also accused of being lovers by the head of a recall bid against Skelly. Governor Meekham was reproved by another legislator 2 months later when he was impeached by the state Senate. Senator Tony West, who said he prayed about what to say, read Meekham excerpts from M. Scott Peck's book, People of the Lie, saying Meekham was part of the evil and showed signs of ambulatory schizophrenia. After his impeachment, Meekham and his brother Willard still faced their criminal trial on perjury counts. It was reported that before the trial, Evan's lawyers met with the state attorney general and proposed that the charges be dismissed if Evan Meekham left Arizona to go on a mission for the church. Meekham said he was flabbergasted that the meeting took place. Because of the trial, BYU refused to let Meekham speak to its campus Republicans Club. This outraged some BYU alumni who felt that the university was being too harsh with Meekham. When Meekham spoke at Altamont High School's graduation exercises, a reporter asked him whether standards are lower at Altamont High than at BYU. Meekham replied, "I still have my temple recommend. If I had moral problems, I wouldn't still have a temple recommend." During the criminal trial, lawyers for the defense argued that the Meekham brothers were Mormon men of good background. Attorneys who later analyzed the case agreed that the Meekham lawyers' best move was their decision to keep their clients off the witness stand. The jury acquitted the Meekhams, stating that they had no proof that the Meekhams knowingly erred on their campaign reports. On the night of his acquittal, Evan Meekham attended the temple. Since the acquittal, Arizona is slowly returning to normal. Only time will determine if Meekham will damage the church's image. Some church members attribute the harshness of the church's recent political neutrality statement to the Meekham incident. But has Evan Meekham taught us any lessons? We have the opportunity for personal introspection, which could be beneficial, but if we cannot look within, we will become more set in our beliefs. Some persons outside the church are now bitter towards Latter-day Saints. Those outside the church should ask themselves, "Do I believe all Mormons are unfit for public office? Do I assume they all think and act like Ev? Can I judge my Mormon acquaintances as individuals instead of pigeonholing them?" Church members against Meekham believed he was an embarrassment to the church. They believed the broad spectrum of political belief within the church was being misrepresented by the Meekhamites. They believe there is more to being a politician than being a good Mormon. They do not believe that God calls politicians to do his bidding. Those within the church who resisted Meekham should ask themselves, "Did I bring the church into the limelight by attacking Meekham as a fellow Latter-day Saint? Did I overreact to accusations that Meekham represents all LDS? Did I mistakenly conclude that Meekham and his followers believe I have a religious obligation to support him? Do I deny authoritarian church members their place in society and in the church?" Meekham's supporters saw his struggles in black and white terms with good guys and bad guys. Some Meekhamites felt their actions, even accusations, religious threats, or violence, were justified because they were battling the forces of Satan. Meekhamites equated right belief with good governorship. They believed that the governor was a good man and a victim of conspiracy because it was impossible for them to believe that he was a bad man and the victim of his own evils. They could not allow for a gray area in which the governor was the victim of both his own inadequacies and the people who perceived those inadequacies as a detriment to the state. They relied on the simple faith that God blesses the righteous efforts of his church. They believed Meekham had divine approval and the Constitution needed saving. Those who supported Meekham must ask themselves, how prepared was this man to assume the tremendous responsibilities he faced? Have I supported him just because he was LDS? Have I bound politics and religion more closely than I should have to the detriment of both? Do I resent the political apathy I perceive in most members of the church? Why did I believe that supporting the governor was necessary, sometimes to the point of religious blackmail? Have I reacted to the criticism against Meekham as if it were persecution against me and my beliefs. Perhaps the most significant result of this Mikkim ordeal has been the pitting of church member against church member. If we're to become unified as a church in Arizona, we must continue to search for what has been called unity in the sense in the essentials, tolerance in non-essentials. Our challenge is to search for common ground with our sisters and brothers, realizing that for now, the umbrella of Mormonism is expansive enough to cover Latter-day Saints of differing political opinions. Thank you.
Arizona's first Mormon governor puzzled many. The tenacious native of northern Utah struggled five times to win the governorship, only to be impeached a little more than a year later, promising a cooperative and responsive administration in his inaugural address. Evan Mikkim quickly became the center of confrontation and controversy. Through Mikkim's indiscreet remarks and temerarious manner, Arizonans also realized that his approach to politics differed considerably from previous state politicians. Consequently, many divided vehemently over the enigmatic governor during his brief tenure. Was he the narrow-minded, racist, self-righteous pariah his critics believed him to be, or was he, on the other hand, the refreshingly candid, highly moral, business-like conservative his supporters saw? The debate still rages. Although Arizona Mormons decried attempts by the Phoenix media to explain Governor Mikkim through his religion, an examination of his political views within the framework of political Mormonism is appropriate and enlightening. As Sammy Jenkins affirmed in his apologetic work, Mikkim, Arizona's Fighting Governor, to understand Mikkim, one would have to understand the influence the church has had in his life. Indeed, the Mikkim ideology is itself part of a larger phenomenon in Mormonism, which seeks to spiritually justify a particular political agenda, usually conservative, with an assortment of quotes from the Brethren, the Founding Fathers, and from Scripture. Although the church has repeatedly declared its political neutrality, the latest letter in June being the most emphatic, the study of the Mikkim ideology as an outgrowth of Mormonism is particularly important in light of Thomas Monson's recent appeal to the saints to further their influence through greater civic participation, as certain tenets of Mormonism profoundly influence the political thought of Evan Mikkim, namely patriotism, prophecy, and paranoia. His rise and fall reveal schismatic currents in Mormon thought, and may foreshadow greater controversy as more Mormons are entering the political arena to fulfill prophecy. Like many members of the church, the formative years of Evan Mikkim coincided with the tremendous challenges and changes facing the 20th century. Born at the end of the Red Scare in 1924, he spent his boyhood in the Great Depression. He grew to manhood as America turned its attention from the ordeal of World War II, only to face the Cold War, McCarthyism, and civil rights. The Supreme Court dismantled the legal scaffolding of segregation and outlawed prayer in the schools while Mikkim settled in Arizona to raise a family. He entered politics while American trained forces landed at the Bay of Pigs. Turning his energy to his car dealership after one term as a state senator, Mikkim watched as American society reeled from the counterculture, student riots, and political assassinations. His search for answers inevitably led him to draw from the strength and stability of his Mormon heritage. Despite the remote and bucolic setting of the Mikkim homestead in northern Utah, significant elements coalesced over the Depression-swept farmland to influence the nascent political thought of young Evan. The desperation of the Great Depression and the hope of the New Deal battered harmlessly about the shelter of the Uinta Mountains as Evan learned the value of hard work, tenacity, and independence from a father he idolized. Talk of politics in the Mikkim home was minimal, yet the eventual intrusion of federal agents offering economic relief jolted young Evan as he listened to his father's shocked reaction. "Ina," said a bewildered Adelbert Mikkim to his wife, "I just saw the damnedest thing. They're giving money away." To Dad, Evan later recalled, "That was incomprehensible. I heard him lecture my uncle about there being no free lunch. He taught us that we pay for everything we get. If in no other way, it will be a loss of character." Convinced that President Roosevelt's programs ultimately corrupted the nation, the elder Mikkim shared his aversion for the Roosevelt administration and his Eastern liberal establishment with the malleable youth. The teachings of the church also molded the character of Evan Mikkim as he embraced Mormonism in earnest. The love of God, home, and country seeded inside him as he saw his small Mormon community of Mount Emmons, Utah, now known as Altamont, in action. Juxtaposed to government welfare, Meekum cherished the individual freedom and dignity the church programs offered its members. The principle of personal revelation, in particular, later proved to be a significant determinant in his political fate and his fundamental in understanding the zeal that has characterized his political career. Close friends of Evan Meekum disclosed that he had received revelation foretelling of future public service. Crispin Lewis, publisher of a local Mormon newspaper, the Latter-day Sentinel, wrote, "I'm sure if you were to visit with him personally, he would share with you his story of why he decided to run. To the world, it looked like vain ambition. To the many who try to follow promptings in their lives, they knew that there was another dimension to his decision." W. Cleon Skousen, Meekum's personal friend and mentor, also echoed the same message at a rally in Mesa last year. Despite the pastoral serenity of Meekum's youth, however, traits of the brash behavior and intolerance that plagued his administration appeared at an early age. Admittedly, Meekum professes to favor cooperation over confrontation. "I'm not the fighting kind," he insists. Yet in the tradition of Orrin Porter Rockwell, his zealotry for righteousness sent him recklessly charging into more than one situation when patience and diplomacy might have won him friends instead of enemies. His semi-autobiographical account is strewn with tales of chauvinism for righteousness' sake. He recounts with pride in Come Back America, for example, his defiant stand before a neighborhood bully, a Nazi interrogation officer, and powerful Phoenix businessmen, how he led a revolt of district managers against their state coordinator, and how he delighted in outwitting and outsmarting his political rivals. Meekum appears to have been more inspired as a child with tales of Christ's verbal victories over the scribes than with his Sermon on the Mount, with the stripling warriors than with the people of Ammon. Thrust from the shelter of the Uintas into a rapidly changing world by the Second World War, Evan Meekum's political views reveal an apparent longing for the stability of pre-war Mount Emmons, as reflected in the title of his book, Come Back America. Themes from his childhood, such as the primacy of the Constitution, reverence to God, individual freedom, and hard work, punctuate his plan to cure America of its ills. Religion, in particular, undergirds his vision for good government. There is a religious foundation, he observed, to all ideas of governance that rise above tyranny. Meekum found in W. Cleon Skousen, the Moses of Mormonism's right wing, a kindred spirit and teacher who significantly refined his views. Skousenism, which is rooted in the political philosophy of men mingled with scripture, is a relatively simple... is a relatively simple yet significantly familiar message of apostasy and restoration. In the Edenic days of America, so the story goes, the founding fathers, like secular patriarchs, descended from the Constitutional Convention with a divinely inspired document. Impious and conspiring men, however, fell away from the plain and precious truth contained in the Constitution and led the nation into political apostasy, which Skousen identifies as American socialism. Thus, Skousenism works to save America from certain destruction by bringing about a political restitution of all things as at first. The religious fervor that both Skousen and Meekum share for America and its destiny clearly derive from the heart and soul of Mormonism. Tolstoy, as we are fond of quoting, correctly identified Mormonism as the American religion. The Book of Mormon is replete with prophecies concerning the chosen state the American continent has in the eternal scheme. Revelations contained in the Doctrine and Covenants canonize the Constitution and beatify the Founding Fathers. The Hanging by a Thread prophecy attributed to Joseph Smith, which foretells of a ravaged Constitution rescued by the elders of Israel, intertwines the fate of this nation with the Church. And innumerable general authorities have preached unwavering patriotism from the pulpit. The Church has therefore sanctified super-patriotism by interweaving Americana throughout the fabric of Mormonism. The Mormonization of the Founding Fathers. Within the sanctuary of the St. George Temple, Wilford Woodruff envisioned the signers of the Constitution requesting that the ordinances of salvation be performed in their behalf. Although this non-canonical revelation is itself doctrinally innocuous, the net effect on Mormonism is significant. It contributes, I believe, to the preponderance of historical mythology disseminated by Skousenism. Woodruff's vision, which is nothing less than a spiritual revision of history, hints that men like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, and Thomas Jefferson were really like us, Mormons in powdered wigs. This sanitized view of colonial Americans is therefore promulgated by Skousen's organization, the National Center for Constitutional Studies, as the correct version of American history, which wrests credibility from the wealth of knowledge accumulated by historical research. This also contributes to an inordinate emphasis in Skousenism to rely upon the political philosophy of 18th century men to solve 20th century problems. Our nation has strayed from the original success formula built into the Constitution by our founding fathers, reads an NCCS tract. A return to these fundamental principles will renew our possibilities for social, political, and economic well-being. Such a return would include abolishing the Federal Reserve and returning to a gold standard, canceling federal aid for education, farms, certain welfare programs, and repealing regulatory legislation. In short, Skousenism's plan for national salvation is a course of political repentance, a cry to return to the faith of the founding fathers. Although Skousenism has ideologically extracted from Mormonism, our modern prophets have also directly and indirectly conferred credibility upon Mormonism's political messiahs. Many of Skousen's followers within the church believe that he was called by David O. McKay to found the NCCS. Whether the prophet actually encouraged Skousen is a moot point. His recognition of the naked communists during the October 1959 General Conference stands as a testament to Skousenites of the divinity of Brother Cleon's mission. Ezra Taft Benson's patriotical blessing on the NCCS, as well as his attendance at Mecham's inaugural, have also contributed to the appearance of church approval. Convinced of the veracity of Skousenism, Evan Mecham envisioned utilizing the governorship of Arizona as the vehicle that would implement Skousen's detailed agenda for righteous government and lead the prophesied salvation of the Constitution. Like a modern King Benjamin, Mecham dreamed of teaching and leading the state of Arizona away from the throes of federal intervention to redeem its right of autonomy envisioned by the Founding Fathers. Once the light of states' rights shone forth from under the bushel of federal bureaucracy, Mecham reasoned, other states would soon follow. The growing revolution would then ultimately force the federal government into a constitutional showdown. I knew it would be a difficult task, but it seemed to be the only chance we had, he explained. Washington was too far gone to ever engage in its own reform. Ironically, Mecham's genuine desire to fulfill prophecy and save the nation appears also to have contributed to the cavalier manner which offended his colleagues and estranged his constituents. Possessing a religious conviction of the only true course that leads to political salvation constructed the more patriotic-than-thou attitude which permeated his administration, much in the same manner which a holier-than-thou attitude has plagued Mormonism since Joseph Smith announced that the religious strivings of his sectarian counterparts were in vain. Why should I resign, Mecham told the state after months of controversy, and give this state over to someone who doesn't care for it as much as I do? Clearly, Mecham's zealotry for righteousness, fueled by his faith in the promise of political leadership, also engendered the enfant terrible reputation he obtained while doggedly pursuing public office. After serving one term as a state senator in the early 1960s, he broke with the leaders of the Republican Party and unsuccessfully bid for the United States Senate. Incensed at the way the party selected its candidate for governor in the next election, Mecham again revolted from the party leadership and ran unsuccessfully for governor in 1964. For two more decades, Mecham ran for governor in every election, often in blatant disregard for Republican strategy. Finally, in 1986, after a particularly vicious battle in the Republican primary, Evan Mecham edged out the divided Democratic ticket. On the eve of his campaign victory, reporters clamored around the newly elected governor, thrust their microphones in his face, and asked the inevitable question, "How do you feel?" "Pretty damn good," was the only reply the teary-eyed candidate could muster. Many that night failed to understand the profound significance the election had for Evan Mecham. His victory was more than a personal triumph, or even a vindication for past defeats. The evidence suggests that, most importantly for Evan Mecham, his election to the governorship that night was a reaffirmation of his deepest religious convictions and nothing less than the divine mandate. Yet the faith and vision that sustained his long and arduous drive to win the governorship also laid the foundation for his downfall. His critics complained that Governor Mecham acted as if he was responsible only to God. Ignoring political dynamics, Mecham abhorred compromise, believing that it weakened just legislation. All too many fall for the slogan, "You've got to go along to get along," he complained. "When faced with things that are not right, I have found that I prefer to fight rather than settle for the wrong things." He likewise refused to listen to criticism, dismissing his critics on one occasion as rabid left-wingers who really want to give me a rash. On another occasion, he charged that Arizona Democrats just don't have enough work to do, so they have to try and find somebody to harass. "I really don't pay any attention to them, so they lose their total effect on me." If Mecham believed, in fact, that he was called to the governorship in fulfillment of prophecy, and that the political machinery in Arizona was corrupt, as will be explored later, then why should he have feared man more than God? He had a mission to perform, and even if the billowing surge conspired against him, and if the very jaws of hell gaped open at him, he was going to remain valiant to his charge. It is important to have God as a co-partner in all governmental acts, he told the Mesa audience last year. He will tell us the course to steer. I'm not looking for an easy way out, he said about controversy on another occasion. You do the things you need to do. That's the responsibility of leadership. If you're not going to be responsible, you shouldn't be a leader. Meekham's vision of responsible leadership, therefore, was to lead, teach, and expound righteous ideals to his constituents, who were not always the willing recipients of his wisdom. Controversy followed the governor as he proselytized his vision of righteous leadership and responsible government. The public reacted in immediate outrage, for example, to one of Governor Meekham's first official acts, rescinding the state holiday honoring Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Meekham justified his action by arguing that his predecessor, Bruce Babbitt, decreed the holiday illegally while pandering to blacks in preparation for his presidential bid. His sole concern, he insisted, was that the holiday was unconstitutionally declared and therefore illegal. Yet when pressed by reporters for his own personal feelings about Dr. King, Meekham responded, He's been blown up by others and doesn't deserve a holiday. The people who want to recognize Martin Luther King can recognize him till the cows come home. They can recognize him 365 days a year. Why is it so important to force everyone else to recognize him? Meekham's assessment that Dr. King is undeserving of a national holiday, unfortunately, has a strong precedent within Mormonism. Fellow arch-conservative and Republican Ezra Taft Benson maintained in his popular work, An Enemy Hath Done This, that Martin Luther King was a communist and that the civil rights movement he championed was communist-inspired. The man who is generally recognized as a leader of the so-called civil rights movement, wrote Benson, is a man who has lectured at a communist training school, who has solicited funds through communist sources, who is affiliated with the communist fronts, who is often praised in the communist press, and who unquestionably parallels the communist line. Clearly, many in the church recognize that the political opinions expressed in Benson's works do not constitute church policy. Yet the customary disclaimers contained in the preface of such books are often overshadowed by the stature of the author's calling. Benson's opinions as a man and as a prophet are not easily separated in the minds of some members, particularly when we are raised to follow the counsel of the brethren unfailingly. Meekham's supporters, therefore, relied frequently upon the works by Benson and other general authorities to spiritually justify Governor Meekham's right-wing politics. Ignoring the outcry over the King holiday, Meekham steadfastly held to his position while managing to alienate other minority groups in Arizona. He plunged deeper into controversy by staunchly defending the historical usage of Pickaninny in Cleon Skousen's The Making of America. He affronted Hispanics by hiring a former beauty queen and fellow Mormon for a community liaison because he was so dazzled by her beauty. He carelessly joked about the shape of Japanese eyes while speaking before a Rotary Club and testified to a Nepal Jewish congregation, in a synagogue no less, that Jesus Christ is the head of this nation. The clamoring cries of cultural insensitivity and racism steadily increased as the governor carelessly spoke his mind. Yet Meekham insisted that his remarks were taken out of context, and like many Mormons, ardently maintained that he is culturally and racially sensitive. He was quick to point out that he selected his appointees based solely upon their qualifications, almost as quickly as he was to boast of being the first Arizona governor to appoint a Native American and a black to cabinet positions. I'm not a racist, he said. I've got black friends. I employ black people. I don't employ them because they're black. I employ them because they're the best people who applied for the cotton picking job. It may very well be true that Meekham is, in fact, colorblind. Yet racist imagery abounds in Mormon scripture and has reared its ugly head more than once in the history of Mormonism. Moses 7:8, for example, suggests that God gave Cain and his descendants a mark of blackness because he murdered his brother. Whether this mark applied to all blacks is unclear. Yet the message that skin color is derived from righteousness or the lack thereof is plain. Indeed, prior to President Kimball's revelation emancipating the priesthood to all worthy men, speculation that the spirits of black men were somehow less valiant in the preexistent was common among the saints. Numerous passages in the Book of Mormon also indicate that Laman and his descendants were marked by a dark skin because of their wickedness, and that the Nephites were blessed with a white skin because of their righteousness. Even though the wording of the Book of Mormon has been changed in recent editions to favor a figurative interpretation, many Mormons continue to believe that righteous Lamanites, in fulfillment of prophecy, literally turn white as the scales of darkness fall from their eyes. Clearly, Mormon scripture has perpetuated the belief that skin color is a barometer of righteousness. As Mecham continued to promulgate standards common to Mormonism, other Arizonans joined the recall bandwagon. He infuriated women by publicly espousing the belief suggested by President Benson in the annual Parents Fireside that working women cause problems in the home. He enraged the homosexual community by suggesting that the First Amendment does not apply to homosexuals. He demanded that a caller on a radio talk show give him a list of homosexuals in the government. When another caller claimed to be a homosexual member of the church, as Karen read, Mecham retorted, "The church I belong to does not allow homosexuals to participate under any circumstances. It is not an alternative lifestyle. It is not an acceptable lifestyle." Clearly, Mecham's zealotry for righteousness, as he understands it, contributed to the dogmatic and demagogic side of the governor which his enemies saw. If Mecham viewed his election as a fulfillment of prophecy, as the evidence suggests, then it is possible that he also viewed his critics within a cosmic reference as well. By criticizing righteous ideals and by working in opposition to one who was called to teach true principles of government and lead the people of Arizona from error, were not his critics ultimately opposing the will of God? Hence, the governor's zest in declaring non-persons of his critics was strikingly similar to that of a bishop excommunicating apostates from the faithful flock. Mecham's search for the causes of the rapid changes in American society, coupled with his early and persistent campaign losses, also apparently convinced him that a conspiracy was afoot in purposeful sabotage of people, economy, and social structure. Mecham's introduction to Skousenism, which is the embodiment of Dr. Richard Hofstadter's politics of paranoia, did not help matters. Like Skousen, Mecham believes in the existence of a monolithic world conspiracy which operated on many levels to destroy America. Come Back America suggests, for example, that Japan cooperated with OPEC in an international conspiracy to destroy the American economy during the 1970s. Aided from within by environmentalists and unions, crippling the American auto industry was to be the coup d'etat. Out of the resulting chaos, he surmised, the socialists would finish destroying the republic and emerge with a socialist dictatorship. Thanks to American ingenuity, the auto industry bounced back and saved the country from certain destruction. Subversive groups, however, have already seized control of the federal government from within. America, according to Mecham, has undergone two other revolutions since the initial revolt against England in the 18th century. The second revolution grew out of the Wilson administration with the help of Eugene Debs, founder of the American Socialist Party. In 1933, a carefully orchestrated socialist conspiracy successfully, yet secretly, swept into Washington with the New Deal legislation of President Roosevelt. Unbeknownst to most Americans, each subsequent administration has methodically edged America away from constitutionalism and capitalism towards a socialist dictatorship. This has been accomplished largely because the American public, Mecham surmises, has been duped into supporting this entrenched and illegal bureaucracy through government handouts and has been indoctrinated through the socialist-controlled educational system. Mecham's third revolution began in 1980 with the election of Ronald Reagan, whom Mecham enthusiastically hailed as the political messiah that would lead the fight to free America from bondage. Although Mecham has not claimed that socialists are controlling Arizona, he ardently believes that big business and special interest groups have secretly controlled the state for decades. Mecham asserts that while serving as a state senator in the early 1960s, he was secretly approached by a representative of, quote, the establishment, unquote, an organization of powerful Phoenix businessmen, which allegedly controlled the Arizona legislature, offered him money and favors if he would join. Naturally, he declined and turned his energy to exposing the conspiracy and freeing Arizona from tyranny. Subsequently, he has blamed the establishment for his numerous campaign losses over the next two decades. To date, Mecham has accused almost all of his critics of cooperating in a high-level conspiracy, from Attorney General Bob Corbin to Arizona Republic editor Pat Murphy and recall organizer Ed Buck. Mormonism may have also engendered Mecham's paranoid style politics. Indeed, the fulcrum of Mormonism's legitimacy within the religious community rests upon apostasy to justify its uniqueness. As a Catholic scholar told James Talmadge, "You Mormons are all ignoramuses. You don't even know the strength of your own position. It is so strong that there is only one other tenable in the whole Christian world, and that is the position of the Catholic Church. If we have the apostolic succession from St. Peter, as we claim, there is no need of Joseph Smith and Mormonism. But if we have not that succession, then such a man as Joseph Smith was necessary. It is either the perpetuation of the gospel from ancient times or the restoration of the gospel in latter times. Mormon scripture also teaches that the entire span of human history is a never-ending saga of good versus evil, transgression and redemption, apostasy and restoration. Even the plan of salvation is impregnated with this theme. If each world is to have its own Satan and each kingdom its Christ, as is commonly speculated, the conspiracy and apostasy are integral parts of the grand order. Joseph Smith's hanging by a thread prophecy, as well as Wilford Woodruff's vision, therefore, projects Mormonism's religious theme of apostasy and restoration onto the political past and future of the United States. "We laid the foundation of the government you now enjoy, and we never apostatized from it," recorded President Woodruff of his visit with the Founding Fathers. "But we remained true to it, and were faithful to God." Joseph Smith reportedly prophesied that the time would come when the Constitution and the country will be in danger of overthrow, and that this people will step forth and save it from the threatened destruction. This spiritual revision of secular history clearly implies that America has fallen from a supernal state and is in need of redemption. Since change is perhaps the greatest constant throughout history, such a view of human nature becomes self-fulfilling prophecy. These revelations of Joseph Smith and Wilford Woodruff, though non-canonical, also harness Mormonism's messianic desire to save the religious world from apostasy and channel that energy into Mormon political action. Why else would a politically naive yet profoundly religious Evan Mecham venture out into the vortex of worldly politics, ultimately sacrificing his business and reputation, if he did not first believe that the country he loved was being destroyed by conspiratorial forces and was in need of a savior? Thus, by intertwining Mormonism with the fate of the United States, the Church has inadvertently given credibility to conspiracy theorists wrapped with patriotic fervor. Ironically, although the framework of political Mormonism is used to explain the enigma of Evan Mecham, Mecham himself does not agree that Mormonism was a significant factor in his administration. As Karen quoted, "I never involved the Church in politics," he insisted. "The brethren have said to get involved civically. We never do it in the name of the Church. I adhere to that strictly." Yet, as Richard Vetterly so cogently argued, the Mormon political and religious philosophy cannot be separated. The inseparability of the two aspects of their philosophy has made the Mormons a highly political entity. Clearly, Mormonism was a significant determinant in the development of Mecham's political philosophy, and Clearly, Mormonism was a significant determinant in the development of Mecham's political philosophy, and has continued to influence his career in public service. Although Mormonism has been used in this survey to define Evan Mecham, it would be incorrect, however, to conclude that Mecham can likewise define Mormonism. Certainly, the respected careers of other Mormon politicians prove otherwise. Yet the stormy career of Evan Mecham, in many ways, elucidates conflicting values in Mormonism. On the one hand, we preach and glorify chauvinism, couched in terms of diligence, valiancy, true to the cause, and steadfastness. We sing hymns with battle imagery, and freely use idioms which perpetuate the siege mentality of our persecuted pioneer ancestors. The term "the world," for example, is liberally used in colloquial reference to all who do not embrace Mormonism, with underlying implications that they will not convert due to the universal love of lasciviousness. It is not uncommon, therefore, to hear Mormons speak of the world as not being able to understand us, or that the world is growing more wicked daily, as if all non-members were united in a monolithic effort to counteract righteousness. Yet we ardently embrace the ideals of democratic pluralism, on the other hand, and consider the principle of free agency a universal axiom. We profess that all men may worship God according to the dictates of their own conscience, and stress the virtue of learning to live in the world. That Arizona Mormons battled over the spiritual and political ramifications of the Mecham administration illustrates the divisiveness of such values, and may presage a potential national schism should a devout and dogmatic Mormon seriously run for president. Perhaps a call to reassess the Church's hands-off policy when dealing with worldly politics is in order. We must acknowledge the potential that Mormonism has to engender a particular political aptitude, regardless of official pronouncements of institutional neutrality, as several Mormon scholars have already recognized. It's not enough to simply preach patriotism, particularly if we believe that we're going to be the people who will save this nation, as every prophet has affirmed since Joseph Smith. Since the NCCS is strongly supported by members of the Church, whose America will Mormons therefore work to save? Cleon Skousen's or Jesse Jackson's? If even the Founding Fathers themselves disagreed, sometimes vehemently, over the Constitution, which interpretation of the Constitution will we therefore champion? Clearly, we must therefore further examine political Mormonism, what that ideological tradition is, and determine where we want to take it before it takes us. Thank you.
I'll be very brief in my comments so that you can have an opportunity to ask questions before 6 o'clock. I had to leave in the middle of the day and drive to Idaho to preach at my uncle's funeral, so if any of you get a free ticket in this talk to the Celestial Kingdom, just take off and go, because I don't know where I mentally am. As a native of Idaho for about 20 years, every night I'd pray that George Hansen would disappear. As an LDS representative from Idaho in Washington, D.C., I even prayed at one time in 1979 the Ayatollah would exchange the 52 hostages for him. But it is unfortunate, I think, that he was replaced in the national eye by Evan Mecham. And I think, as both Karen and Ed have pointed out very persuasively, that there has been considerable damage done both internally to the LDS Church in Arizona as well as externally politically in what a Mormon might or might not do in running for office in Arizona again. I think hopefully we can put much of this in historical perspective, analyze where it's coming from, why it happened, and try to correct certain things. But it seems like we don't learn very well from our history, that we have not learned well from some of the political activities of Mormons in Missouri or Illinois or at the turn of the century in Utah that brought down national and local wrath upon them. I think one of the most significant things that comes out of this Mecham case, and I'm not going to say much more, is the fact that what happens when a certain particular ideology runs amok. And that is when you combine politics and religion to the degree that people do, and they put the Lord in a hell of a bind. Because, unfortunately, politics is not that simple. And I think you take a person who is as political as a Reed Smoot, or a B.H. Roberts, or J. Reuben Clark, or even George Romney, who served for many years, they never, I don't think, presume publicly that they were God's agents trying to save, you know, the Constitution. I think that God cares as much about who's prime minister in Australia as he does who's governor of Arizona. But the way people interpret that, I think, has become what's important. And I think out of that you get the concept that comes, as has been mentioned, out of the 50s, whether it's the publication of The Naked Communist or The Red Carpet or An Enemy Within or a variety of other things, that somehow this nation that has spawned a church that is supposed to roll forth like Daniel's Rock and encompass the world is going to be in danger. And so, consequently, because of internal American political considerations, you develop a conspiracy theory that somehow the nation that spawned this is going to be encased in turmoil and be saved. At the same time, your church is dealing with East Germans and Poles and Hungarians and Yugoslavs and Chinese and other communists so that they can deal with them and have an opportunity to work within their countries for members of the church that are already there or may be there in the future. And I think it creates a number of great ironies. The whole conspiracy theory, of course, of history is one that is based on a simplistic view of the world by clientele who want to remain uninformed. That has to be attacked by LDS people as much as anything. I think there are a lot of things you could talk about, the flirtations with the John Birch Society in the past, a number of things that have taken place that would give credence to the idea that in certain issues the church has become very politically right-wing. But I think in this case we're here to discuss Evan Mecham and Arizona and the impact of the church there. And so with that, I will now turn it over to the audience. I'll repeat all your questions because these are being taped and can be purchased. Yes, sir.
Yes, I just had a two-part question.
Don't make it so dang long, Newell. I got to repeat the damn thing.
My first question deals with Benson's relationship, President Benson's relationship with Meekum. Because you mentioned that he was present at Meekum's inauguration, and then you mentioned that evidently there was some communication and contact, and that, of course, is I guess the twist on it is the interesting part about Benson, who President Benson's nephew,
grandson.
And then the second part of my question is a little bit different. Is on the was there any public opinion polls taken amongst the church members, you know, like the Gallup poll, to gauge what support for and against Ev Meekum was during the whole controversy? Those are my questions.
There's a two-part question. One dealing with the extent of the relationship between President Benson and ex-Governor Meekum. And then a second one involving whether or not there was ever a poll that would indicate a percentage of LDS support for or against Meekum.
I can answer the first question. I interviewed Steve Benson and asked him what his grandfather's relationship was to Meekum, and he said he had never heard Meekum's name mentioned by his grandfather until this event. Apparently they were friends from quite a few years back, maybe 20 years back. I asked if they sent Christmas cards, and he said, I don't know. He sees in Benson certainly a compadre, a buddy, but I don't think they're that close.
Okay, to answer the second part of your question, no, there was never an official poll taken, unfortunately. But in my Sunstone article, I try and determine how many Mormons actually supported Evan Meekum. It's difficult to determine because the subscribership to the Latter-day Sentinel, which was typically pro-Meekum, runs about one subscriber for every 20 Mormons. The letters in the Latter-day Sentinel were running about 10-1 in favor of Evan Meekum as well. No, we don't know, but I suspect...
I don't think the church would want to do that.
Yeah, I don't think the church would want to. I would just right off the top of my head, I would suspect 20% supported Meekum. 20%. That's my a conservative estimate.
Also, you notice in my Mark Killian told me that the calls were very strong initially until Meekum began testifying, and then they kind of petered out.
What's the percentage of Latter-day Saints in Arizona in the state as a whole?
Mesa is. Let me find that.
There are a question on the percentage of LDS people in Arizona. No, that's three for you. That's enough.
I can tell you the percentage, but there are 200,000 LDS members in Arizona.
All right. Jeff.
Ross, I'm not going to make you repeat this. I'll try to tell it. I had a couple of questions or a couple of statements I was going to make earlier, having known the Meekum family pretty well back when I was about 18 and working on his campaign for mayor when he was running against John Driggs.
And tell stories.
And one of the points that I wanted to make is that, first of all, that I've got a lot of Meekum stories that I guess could kick them around some more. But one of my concerns here is that there are big aspects to Ev Meekum's character and background and those kind of things that were not really brought it up at all here. One thing that's important to realize, we see Ev Meekum as being paranoid. I think he had some legitimate reason and right in Arizona politics to be paranoid. For years he ran a daily and a weekly newspaper that always attacked he, and it's kind of interesting that Gene Pulliam, who was the publisher of the newspapers, is the grandfather of the new vice presidential nominee, Dan Quayle, and the one that he got all of his money from. And but Ev Meekum and the Arizona Republic had a long-standing feud, and I think that there was also this other dimension of Jewish politics in Arizona with Barry Goldwater, Harry Rosenzweig, a lot of the establishment in Arizona politics. That Ev took a lot of things personally, and I think he saw things in light of Jews versus Mormons sometimes, or, you know, the big newspapers against us. And I think that he had a lot of right to do that. I think that also, one of the things I remember right after his unsuccessful campaign for mayor, we were going to start a little group. I have come quite a bit more liberal in my politics and views since I was 18 years old, but one of the things that Ev did, I remember he was talking about wanting to support Ronald Reagan for president. This was back in the early 70s, and someone in this little group said, well, Reagan used to be a Democrat, though we can't do that. And Ev Meekham said, well, Jesus hung and died on the cross to pay for those kind of sins. And there were several other kinds of things, and I'm not saying this to really stab Ev Meekham. I mean, there was another thing. Someone brought up a member, an idea that one of the members of this new group, and he was a Jewish fellow, and Ev said, we can't have any Jews in the leadership of this because a person who doesn't believe in Jesus Christ cannot understand the divine destiny of this land. Now, those things are anti-Semitic. There's problems with them, but I also appreciate and understand where Ev Meekham was coming from. I drove over to that meeting with him in his car, and for a half hour before, he sat there and read the works of Thomas Jefferson and those types of things. I think there's a lot more depth to the man. I think he's very sincere, and I think he's just a part of this religious culture that is very real, and I think he really believed this stuff. And I think that the only problem we have here is I have a lot of friends still in Arizona that felt very strongly for Ev Meekham, and I think maybe there should have been someone here to have supported that side more strongly.
I felt very strongly for Evan Meekham's problems.
If I can comment on that, there's no question in my mind that Evan Meekham was very sincere. He really believes that he's working to save Arizona and working to save the nation as well. Just to answer your statement about, or to respond to your statement about conspiracy in Arizona, I think a lot of his wounds were self-inflicted. Certainly there were people in Arizona politics that didn't appreciate Evan Meekham, and certainly they worked to keep him from office. Whether that constitutes the conspiracy that Evan Meekham envisions, that's a whole other matter. He sees smoke-filled rooms, that democracy does not exist in Arizona, that it is really an oligarchy that is running state politics. So that's my reason.
What's interesting, too, is I don't know if there's a conspiracy to get Meekham, but if I were him, wouldn't I realize the damage I would do by announcing that that was the problem? I mean, wouldn't I realize how people would react to that?
Merrill.
I suggest that there was a conspiracy, and it was conducted, if I could believe what I heard here tonight, it was conducted by Meekham himself. It is interesting to note how many people can destroy themselves with words. You talked about George Romney, a man who had a marvelous reputation. They seriously considered having him run for the presidency. And in one sentence, he destroyed all possibilities when he said, the generals in Vietnam brainwashed me. And I don't want a president. You don't want a president who can be brainwashed. And judging from the quotations you people made of things Meekham said, he destroyed Meekham.
Right. Yes, sir.
I have a brief comment and then a question for Ed. As a proudly active and believing liberal Democrat, and as a proudly believing and active gay man, and as a proudly active and believing Mormon, I am offended and I am embarrassed by what Evan Meekham has done. I have been taught, and I do sincerely believe, in the concept of the body of Christ. Excuse me, I get a little emotional over this. There is diversity within our church, and that is what brings about the dynamics of our religion, that makes it a living religion where we can all participate. Conformity, I see as very stagnant. Ed, my question to you is, since there has been a crucifixion, is there a resurrection? Please tell me no.
I would put money on it. Meekum is clearly a man with a vision. Even though he was kicked out of office, this only confirmed his belief in conspiracy and that America is really in need of his help. When he first was impeached, he announced that he was going to go fishing. Those were his future plans. But he has since formed Ford Arizona Political Action Committee, which is working to rid the state of corrupt politicians who incidentally voted to impeach him as well. So we have not heard the last of him.
Any other questions from the audience? Yes, ma'am.
I think things are coming back together slowly.
Yeah, I would emphasize slowly as well. There were some of us on either side of the fence have yet to get back together and affirm our brotherhood in the church. We're still quite sore with one another.
I know more families were divided than the ones I mentioned, but I wanted to make sure that the ones I mentioned I had quotes on. You understand that? But it was widespread.
And then with no other questions, we'll stand adjourned. Thank you all very much. Really appreciate Karen and Ed coming up from Arizona.
Thank you for coming.